towards Syria. What are they really afraid of?
Well, to be honest with you, after 12 years of war on Syria and failure to impose their own will on the country, Syria now become like a punching bag for United States to affect the events in the Middle East and in the international arena in general. I don't think this is targeted just specifically to weaken Syria. Syria already gone through 12 years of war, and those continuous attack from the Israeli entity, it's only to further advance the goal of United States vis-a-vis Russia and Iran, because we all know there is Iranian advisors in Syria, and those came with the invitation of the Syrian government, but there is no military bases of Iranian in Syria. They are attacking Syrian coast. The murder are Syrian soldiers. There is no doubt in my mind this has nothing to do with Syria. It only has to do with the international event and the Middle East event.
Well, after the attack, we did hear Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal al-Miqdad saying that Israel is playing with fire and it's exposing the entire region and the world, its security and military situation to an explosion. Now, we also heard him saying that Syria will not remain silent in the face of the Israeli aggression, and he threatened that Israelis will be paying the price sooner or later because of this aggression against Syria that has been going on for 10 years now. But will Syria truly be able to deter Zionist aggression against its capital and other governorates in Syria? I mean, what tool is Syria planning on using to deter the Zionists?
Well, let's be realistic. Syria at this moment cannot open another front with Israel or with anybody else. We already have four occupation in Syria. We have the Turkish occupation. We have the American occupation. We have the terrorist ISIS occupation or al-Jolani in Idlib. And then we have the Kurds separatist occupation. So to open a fifth front with any other country will weaken Syria further. So what we are doing right now, and Syria is responding by attacking the military bases of the American in Syria. And we saw that happen yesterday or day before yesterday, or we saw it happening every time the Zionist entity attacks Syria. We respond against the masters.
So do you think that we might see some sort of a retaliation by Syria similar to that we saw in 2017 by downing probably one of the planes at least?
Well, anything like this, I think, will require the approval of the pact, the Iranian, the Russian, the Hezbollah. Syria will never go to war on its own decision. The same thing, I think Hezbollah also will do the same thing. There will be a consultation with all the party, the alliance, because any war and escalation on a bigger scale will require that the other party in that alliance might be involved. So in Syria, after the war started on it, does not have the sole decision-making to go to war or not to go to war. Everything now is with consultation. Any movement you see on the part of the Iranian or Hezbollah on Syria does not happen just out of a single decision. It happened because there was a consultation and the decision made by the allies, all of them, and it's been taken from there on.
So, but some people are a bit frustrated by the Russian stance and the Russian permissive and facilitating, probably. Some people are saying that the Russians are facilitating this for Israel by some analysis who were referring to the removal of the S-300s from Syria. Yet many others think that it is about time that Syria and the axis of resistance respond to the attacks against Syria, because any attack against Syria is considered an attack against the axis of resistance, in order to ensure that this act of aggression and violence will not be repeated under the pretext of avoiding being drawn into a war whose time and place would be actually here determined by the enemy instead of by the axis of resistance. But let me ask you this. What is the main reason that is preventing the entire axis of resistance from retaliating and creating some sort of a deterrence equation similar to that's found between Lebanon and the Zionist entity? Why not create one between Syria and the Zionist entity, at least to prevent violence?
Let's be very clear. War does not be conducted with the hot head. It requires a cold reaction. You do not react immediately just because you want to take a revenge. You need to see after the reaction and taking any action against the Zionist entity, what's the situation in Syria? Do you think the American bases in Syria will be silent? Don't you know that they will be participating in any big scale war? The same thing on the Turkish part, the same thing on the terrorist group in Idlib. So we have more than one item to consider before we go ahead and launch similar war front like Hezbollah. The difference is between Russia and Iran. Russia said it from the beginning. They are not in Syria to protect the President Assad or to be party to any conflict between the Arab and the Zionist entity. Mm-hmm. Russia in there came to Syria with the invitation of the Syrian government solely to prevent the collapse of the government of Syria, regardless who's the president. And President Putin said it out loudly and clear. Lavrov said it also clearly in so many interviews. So everybody who blame Russia for what happening to us is misplacing their blame, actually. As far as Iran and Hezbollah, like I said, I don't think at this stage we are ready for a full-scale war. Once the war started, anybody could start the war, but not everybody could end it the way they want. So
well,
there is more.
In less than a minute, Mr. Aqil, so do you believe that probably the targeting of U.S. occupation bases inside Syrian territory is kind of a retaliation against the aggression coming from both the U.S. and the Zionist entity, or that's a separate thing?
No, I believe it is retaliation, but I think it's a retaliation under the banner of the Syrian resistance, because the army did not claim any responsibility. The Syrian army did not claim any responsibility for that attack. So we're playing the game of we're not attacking you officially as a Syrian army, but the Syrian resistance in the area are attacking you. So everybody got the message that Syria will retaliate from now on against those bases every time it gets attacked by the Zionist entity.
Well, that brings it into a very hot plate for the Americans, who are looting hundreds of billions of dollars worth of gas and oil from Syrian fields. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Aqil Hananu, political commentator, for joining us from Georgia and for
thank
your contribution at this early time in the morning there. Thank you very much. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be discussing what's really going on in Iraq.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Now, the development of events in Iraq depends on the decision of the Federal Supreme Court, which is expected to be issued this week on Wednesday in the lawsuit filed by the Sabr movement before it, calling for the dissolution of the House of Representatives elected last October on the grounds that it exceeded the constitutional deadlines in electing a new president of the republic, and then assigning a government from the largest parliamentary bloc pending the issuance of the decision. The tone of the political debate receded in Iraq, which resulted in more calm on the Iraqi streets. An anxious calm in Iraq in this following report.
It does not seem that eliciting the views of the Shia-Shia fighting in Iraq will lead to a calm at the political level, paving the way for the resumption of negotiations stalled for weeks, with the aim of finding a solution to the crisis in which the country has been floundering since last October. It was clear, though, that Muqtada Sadr, who wanted behind his recent move to give somewhat of a heads-up for his opponents, sensed that things did not go as he planned, which may explain his return, despite his announcement of his retirement from politics, to a violent and unprecedented escalation against the Iraq's coordinating framework. the so-called minister of the leader, also known as Saleh Muhammad al-Iraqi, who tweets on behalf of al-Sadr, lashed out for two consecutive days against the framework for not following the demands of al-Sadr and dedicated his last statement to demand the immediate change of the head of Iraq's resistance, Hashd al-Shaabi, and to remove the Hashd from the green zone and keep it away from border controls, sending a strongly worded message to the Secretary General of Asa'ib Ahlul Haqq, Qais al-Khaz'ali, asking him to rein in what he called impudent militias and renounce what Sadr referred to as the killers. However, choosing to absorb and ignore such statements, Qais al-Khaz'ali asked members of the movement to close all of its offices until further notice, calling on the movement's supporters not to respond to insults directed at him personally, which in turn will facilitate the extraction of conflict from the streets. This attack contrasts with al-Sadr's own praise a few days ago for the role of the Hashd al-Shaabi in ending the sedition, which, despite recording some tensions in the southern governorates, does not seem to have grounds for its ignition in the form of widespread Shia-Shia fighting, which most of the political forces in Iraq are intimidated by, since none of them can bear the burden of its grave effects on the Iraqi scene. While there was no indication of a breakthrough that might re-energize the political dialogue in the next stage, the Federal Supreme Court set a date to issue a decision in the case for dissolving the House of Representatives, making it imperative for all of Iraq's political factions to wait for it, given its decisive impact on the course of developments. However, it may come. All in all, the effort that has been made during the past few days to ward off sedition is not of normal size. None of Iraq's allies remained on the sidelines, with every last one of them intervening in order to prevent the Big Bang. What was remarkable was that Iran and Hezbollah on the one hand and the Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Sistani on the other played a central role in preventing the bloodshed, in fear of possibility of something unthinkable, like a Shia-Shia civil war in an already tormented Iraq.
Now, to discuss this very pressing issue with us from Beirut is Mu'taz Al-Wahwah, political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Mr. Mu'taz. Now, as long as there's no indication that a breakthrough in Iraq has been achieved in a way that relaunches maybe the political dialogue in the country, the Federal Supreme Court's setting of a date to make a decision upon the case of dissolving the House of Representatives seems to have a decisive impact on where things are going in Iraq. Everyone is actually waiting for it. What happens in the event that the decision of the court actually goes against Muqtada Sadr's aspirations?
Well, as we've seen in the past, for us to sit here and sort of draw an accurate description of what might take place when things don't go Muqtada's way, we'd be trying to sort of foretell the future here. What we've seen from Sayyid Muqtada, and rather from his followers, is that they're very erratic. So there's no telling exactly what would happen, whether they would take to the streets, especially now, with Sayyid Muqtada's decision to remove himself from political life. He's left this arena void of any sort of leadership here. Who will call the shots? Who will ask people to take to the streets or not take to the streets? This remains something quite ambiguous at the moment. We saw in the past, however, when things didn't go the way of the Sadri movement, when things didn't go their way, we saw chaos, we saw rioting in the streets, we saw a mini coup, we saw government institutions being taken over, there was violence on the streets, and we can only hope that this time, especially after the last bout of violence in Iraq, and Sayyid Muqtada finally calling his followers to remove themselves from the streets, we hope that there will be a calmer reaction to things. But as we said, if we were to draw an accurate picture, this is merely impossible at the moment.
But what was noticeably, maybe let's say, vigorous about the last statement issued by the so-called minister of the leader, meaning the al-Sadr as the leader here, and his minister known as Muhammad al-Iraqi, Muhammad Saleh al-Iraqi, he demanded that the head of the political body of Iraq's main resistance, al-Hashd al-Shaabi, Mr. Faleh al-Fayyad, be changed, be removed from position because, and I quote here, he does not have a strong personality or mentality, and he is not qualified for the position. What does that have to do with anything concerning the dissolution of parliament or the formation of a new government in Iraq, or at least dialogue between political factions in Iraq?
Absolutely nothing. This is just an indication of political immaturity. When we start to mix, cards and mix issues and tie things that are unrelated to one another, especially in when we're talking about a very delicate situation like Iraq, this is only an indication of political immaturity. Mr. Said Fayyad doesn't represent Parliament. He has nothing to do with Parliament, whether Parliament is dissolved or not. He's not related to the judiciary. He's not tied to any of these decisions. And at the same time, Said Al-Araqi, Muqtada's minister, has nothing to do with Al-Hashd al-Sha'bi and their political makeup. And it's not his call to make, really. All we can tell from this
is that the Hashd al-Sha'bi in Iraq is part of the Iraqi army according to a bill drafted by the parliament.
Correct. So the Hashd al-Sha'bi, yes, the Hashd al-Sha'bi is part of the Iraqi Defense Force, sort of semi-officially tied to the military. So this is another indication that this is not a call of Sadr's minister. It's not his place to say this. And it has nothing to do with parliament at all. This is just the only way that we can describe it is an attempt to cause a bit of chaos, maybe, and buy some time for Muqtada's party, for them to gather themselves, for the Sadr movement to gather themselves and figure out where they want to go from here on.
But that's a bit dangerous and a risky game to play, given that it was not the Hashd al-Sha'bi that was actually maybe taking to the street, Green Zone, or anywhere else. So why in specific would someone who represents al-Sadr himself, who, by the way, thanked al-Hashd al-Sha'bi for keeping peace in Iraq, why would someone like him actually call for such a statement against Hashd al-Sha'bi?
Well, again, we can see now in the Sadri movement, even before Said Muqtada's last week, even before his statement last week where he claimed he was resigning from political life, there is some sort of anarchy amongst the ranks of the Sadri movement. Okay, we're not seeing a clear line of leadership. There isn't. It's not clear who exactly is calling the shots here. Those on the streets are doing one thing. Sadr's minister is saying one thing. Said Muqtada himself is saying another. So it's very unclear at the moment who is actually calling the shots in this movement. If it even is the Sadri movement that is being represented in the streets. And like you said, the Hashd al-Sha'bi had no role in taking to the streets in the Green Zone, although there are some who would like to point the finger at the Hashd al-Sha'bi and say that they were there putting down the protesters and opening fire, and there was absolutely no basis for this at all. Mm-hmm. The Hashd al-Sha'bi took a clear decision to remain neutral during the last bout of violence and step aside even when their positions and their offices and bases were being attacked. Even when the homes of some of their commanders, the personal homes where their families were living, were being shot at, were being petrol bombed, and rioters were attacking their homes, the Hashd al-Sha'bi took a decision to remain neutral and not confront the protesters.
Oh, I have one in mind who would benefit from such actions, but let us stay with the Iraqi political scene here and talk about the Iraqi coordination framework, who also in itself seems to be having some inconsistencies amongst its ranks concerning dealing with the next phase in the country. There are those who are calling for proceeding with the completion of the constitutional context by forming a new government, and those who are calling for calm, for people to just sit tight and wait until we hear something coming from the court and maybe decide later on. Is that an indication that the framework bloc might disintegrate in the event the Supreme Court actually calls for re-elections?
Well, this seems to be the case for all of Iraq. Absolute ambiguity. No one really knows what is going to happen. For those who are calling to stick by current legislation or the current constitution, or if we're going to the other end, or those calling for early elections, no one really seems to have a firm grip of what's going on. And it seems to me, it's making it more and more obvious that whatever decision is going to be made, there are those in Iraq at the moment who are sitting by and are currently waiting events outside of Iraq to take place and base their decisions moving forward on that. There are some waiting on the Iran nuclear deal. There are some waiting on Saudi Arabia's relationship with Iraq, what negotiations will bring. There are some waiting on to see what the Americans are going to bring to the table. Unfortunately, this is the case in Iraq. There are many that will, at the moment, sit by and just wait for further developments in the region and then make their decisions based on that. And this is very, very tense. This is very, very dangerous when we're speaking about a volatile country like Iraq, when we have a void in government, a void in parliament. We are going to see more anarchy in the streets the longer this void continues. These gangs were going to take over the streets. These rioters who were now, as we said, unsure who was controlling them, unsure who was calling the shots, will take momentum. And the coming weeks will show. There needs to be a firm decision taken by any reasonable and logical side in Iraq. The voice of reason needs to take place, and the country's political dialogue must move forward unconditionally. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we are heading for complete anarchy.
Well, I hope that Iraqis take a chance to calm down and sit together and find a way, a peaceful way, to consider the future of their country. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Mohtaz Al-Wahwah, political commentator, for joining us to talk about this very pressing matter in Iraq. And thank you. Now, please stay tuned next week. We have something very, very special for you. Let's see you next week on the Mideast Stream.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا أَوْ you who believe, اِسْتَعِينُوا بِالصَّبْرِ وَالصَّلَاةِ.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, this is the minbar you are listening to. May Allah accept your mourning for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Today we invite you to listen to an English lecture by Brother Amin Rastani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. What we want to do tonight, inshallah, verses of the Quran that will push us to not give up on the aza of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Surah Hud, verse 120. One can say these verses highlight the philosophy and underlying reasoning for why we are continuing the aza of Imam Hussein till today. Sure, we have hadiths in this regard as well, but there will be general verses that will apply to the aza of Imam Hussein as well. Number one, Surah Hud, verse 120. If we are remembering Imam Hussein every year, recounting his history, everyone knows the history of Imam Hussein, yet when I go over the history, it seems that this is the first year it happened. Why do we continue this history, recounting again and again and again? Surah Hud, verse 120, is telling the Prophet about what happens when you recount the history of Awliyaullah in the past. وَكُلًّا نَقُصُّ عَلَيْكَ مِنْ أَنْبَاءِ الرُّسُلِ. We will tell you the story of all these prophets. O Prophet of Allah, we will tell you the story of previous prophets. مَا نُثَبِّتُ بِهِ فُؤَادَكَ. Number one reason. Number two reason, وَجَاءَكَ فِي هَذِهِ الْحَقِّ. Number three reason, مَوْعِذَةٌ. Number four reason, وَذِكْرَى لِلْمُؤْمِنِينَ. This verse of the Qur'an is letting the Prophet know that there are four benefits in recounting the story and stories of the awliyaullah. Now you tell me, does this mean that it's only the prophets now? No, it applies to all awliyaullah. Number one, مَا نُثَبِّتُ بِهِ فُؤَادَكَ. It strengthens your heart, O Prophet. This is the Prophet of Allah, who has the strongest heart, by the way. So you and I, when we go over the history of Imam Hussein, that is going to definitely be strengthening our hearts. How? When you hear of what Imam Hussein went through, yes? For you, of course, it's going to be much easier to make sacrifices. I mean, look, Prophet Nuh, the Holy Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, the Quran tells him, O Prophet of Allah, Nuh was mocked for like 950 years. If you're going to be mocked for 23 years, don't worry. This strengthens the heart, correct? If Prophet Ayyub for 7 years suffered, we've heard his story, correct? He suffered. Physically suffered. Then, O Prophet, if for 3 years you're stuck in Sha'b Abi Talib, that valley, when they were sanctioned, correct? They were besieged. 3 years in the advent of Islam, the Muslimin went through horrors in those 3 years. Famine and hunger, and to the extent that Abu Talib dies, Bibi Khadija dies a little after. It took a toll on the Muslimin. O Prophet of Allah, Ayyub went through 7 years of trial and tribulation. 3 years of Shu'ab Abi Talib, just letting you know this happens. Brothers and sisters, if that's how it works for the Prophet, and we hear the story of Imam Hussein alayhi salam again and again, then we know if a tragedy befalls me, and I say this all the time to our younger ones, when they have this idea of what does God have against me? Why am I going through this? Well, if God, if having trouble, if having tragedy, if having hardship through life, throughout life, equals Allah not liking me, then Imam Hussein must be the one that Allah doesn't like the most. Astaghfirullah. No. Tragedy sometimes has other reasons other than just Allah just not liking me. Alright? So Imam Hussein teaches us, if I'm reminded every year, that's going to give me a boost in my life. When we see the patience of Imam Hussein, we are patient. When we see his courage, when we see his forgiveness and taking grudges out of our hearts, no, I'm going to forgive this person once they actually come up to me and ask me for forgiveness. Well, it's one thing to be careful. If someone's hurt you once or twice, I'm not going to, like, you know, be the same with them anymore. That's for sure. That doesn't mean I'm not going to forgive them. Well, whatever, forgive, I forgive them. Who cares? Whatever they did. Huh? Whatever backstabbing, I forgive. I'm not going to let them backstab me again, though. I'm not going to be dumb about it. Right? But at the same time, I'm going to forgive because Allah says forgive, and inshallah, on the day of judgment, Allah will forgive me. These are two different things here. I might not even talk to that person too much because, once again, I've got to be careful. Right? My back only has so much room to get stabbed in. You know? But the other part, the grudge part, forget that. I ain't got time to worry about that. Imam Hussein, when Hur comes, oh, Imam Hussein, will you forgive me? Imam Hussein, it's as if, all right? It's as if. I'm gonna translate what Imam Hussein says, Imam Hussein on Ashura is like, Hur, like, we don't got time for this, like, stuff, you know? You're come in. You're on this side now. Let's see what we got to do from here on. No, Imam Hussein, I want you to forgive me this and that. Oh, you're here. Finished. You ain't got time for this. We got a lot of work to do. So when I hear this every single year, Hur is a reminder to me. Manuthabitu bihi fu'adak, his openness to letting everyone in. Yeah? All these things. All right. So that's number one. Number two, there has come to you in these stories truth. Haq comes to you. Brothers and sisters, Karbala, I don't care what anybody says, Karbala is the best example where you can easily draw a line between haq and batil. And man, when people actually get exposed the way they're supposed to Karbala, it will knock down dominoes all the way back to Saqifah. That's all I'll say. Yes, sometimes the dominoes will stop somewhere else. Sometimes they'll go all the way back. It's because why? Because there's all haq versus all batil there. So people, they're going to see this. They're going to be like, whoa, wait a minute, what's going on? Now, I'll talk about this one some other night as well. There's stories that, you know, I want to share with you. People who've written books on this. Yeah? لَقَدْ شَيَّعَنِي الْحُسَيْنِ. The guy writes a book called Verily Indeed Hussein Made Me Shia. Well, what's your story? These are things that we'll talk about, inshallah. So haq also comes through these stories. Maw'idha. Maw'idha, usually they'll use the equivalent of preaching, you know, that kind of thing, for maw'idha. So we have this in Urdu probably, in Farsi, okay? But they say, what's the difference between maw'idha? One of the brothers, we were talking about this last night, he was telling me actually. What's the difference between maw'idha and hikmah? Shaykh Mutahhari, in a nutshell, he says, look, hikmah is any good, you know, guidance that one, a person can give somebody else. But maw'idha is that which goes through the ears, doesn't go out through the other ear, but goes down to the heart and touches the heart and brings about change. Brothers and sisters, you tell me, the history of Imam Hussein, I don't know. As I said last night, if that's not going to work, nothing's going to work. The history of Imam Hussein, yes, the repetitive, the one we've heard every year, history of Imam Hussein, is enough to change everything. Why? Because it goes down to the heart, doesn't go through the ears and out the other. Yes, the beautiful things that we do. Last night I pointed to this model here. Yeah, and so I wasn't sure who had done this. And yes, I was told that the scouts, CFK scouts, have done this. All right, this, whoever of our children makes this, it will remain with them forever, inshallah. These are the steps we should be taking as a community. Practical steps, making a difference. I still remember my science projects back in the day. You know those cardboard setups we used to have in science fairs? Remember those? I still remember that. I remember a lot of other things. Why? Because I got involved practically. The history, we got to be smart about it. We got to be efficient about it. For example, this VR thing that you guys got going on. Like, this is big stuff because this was the thing years ago, a few years ago when it started. Now, alhamdulillah, our communities have access to it. Wonderful. Inshallah, you make the most of these things. In one way or another, this history, they did their part. They gave us the raw material. Bismillah. Let me see what you do within the boundaries of Islam, of course. Let me see what you do with this. May Allah give all of you tawfiq in whatever you do in this regard. Maw'idha, it reaches the heart. وَذِكْرَى لِلْمُؤْمِنِينَ, a reminder for the mu'mineen. Alright, so now, that's one verse. The history of the Rusul. You're not going to say that's going to apply to the history of Imam Hussein?
Swear to Allah, whenever I face troubles in my life, I close my eyes and see your shrine and call back every time. Oh, Hussein, you're the love of my heart. You are the light of my eyes. I swear to Allah, until my last breath, I will remember Hussein.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light.
The Creator made Adam in his image, then placed the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint,
a critique of movies with religious themes on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program, Viewpoint on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and my guest speakers in the studio, Sister Asma and Brother Sayyid Abdullah. Sister Asma, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum assalam, thank you for having me once more.
You're welcome. And Sayyid Abdullah, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the studio.
Wa alaikum assalam, wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me here.
You're welcome. Today, we're going to talk about or criticize the movie Dune. It's a 2021 or 21st American epic science fiction movie that we're going to deal with or touch on its critique. But before that, let's take a listen to a short trailer of the movie, and then we will be back.
My planet Arrakis is so beautiful when the sun is low. Rolling over the sands, you can see spice in the air. The outsiders ravage our lands in front of our eyes. Their cruelty to my people is all I've known. What's to become of our world?
Back to the program Viewpoint on RIB English Radio. We are trying to criticize or start actually criticizing the movie Dune, produced in 2021, directed by Denis Villeneuve, and starring, of course, a couple of good actors and actresses from Hollywood, Timothy Chalamet, Zendaya, Oscar Isaac, Rebecca Ferguson, Jason Momoa, and Stellan Skarsgård. Well, about its critical response, Sister Asma, you know, we see the Rotten Tomatoes 83%. Obviously, generally speaking, it's given this movie a positive review.
Yes, of course.
All right, with an average rating of 7.6 out of 10.
Mm-hmm.
And also we have Metacritic, giving a score of 74 out of 100. And finally, we see CinemaScore that gave this movie an average grade of A-, of course, based on an A-plus to mm-hmm. F scale. So how did you think of this movie, given the fact that the budget, of course, is $165 million?
A massive.
Yes, but the box office was three times more. Roughly speaking, it's about $400 million. So how did you make up this movie?
Well, I think this movie could be considered on two dimensions. From one angle, I could say cinematically, it's something very great because it has got some very, very interesting and awesome sort of visual effects. But it has got some thematic ideas inside of it that needs some sort of debate.
Mm-hmm.
And about the scores you already mentioned, I would say that it has been appreciated by most of the audience.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Because, you know, most of the time what we see is just the surface and the depth doesn't matter. And recently people are so much interested in the kind of movies that are fictional and like they're taking you years ahead of the time you're living already. Mm-hmm. And that's maybe something very interesting for specifically
in
youth
light of the
or
fact
the audience.
That it's a kind of science fiction movie.
Yes, sci-fi
course.
Movie, yes. So they are very much interested by people.
I see. Thank you very much. Sayyid Abdullah, you know that the whole story is about like revolving around Paul Atreides, which is the central character in mm-hmm. this movie. In fact, who arrives on Arrakis, which is basically an imaginary piece of land, right? Mm-hmm. After his father accepts the stewardship of the dangerous planet by the Emperor, right? And however, chaos ensues after a betrayal as forces clash to control Melange, a precious resource. Obviously, we are going to talk about that resource and a spice and all the rest of it that goes with the territory of this movie. So how did you find this movie, especially given its length?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. With the movie itself, like, because when I was a little kid, I actually read the novel itself.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, I was captivated by the actual story. And then when the movie was released in 84, the first June.
Yes.
Well, I was very young back then. I was like maybe 2 or 3 years old anyway. So as I grew older, after reading the book, I watched the movie. And I actually watched it a few times as well.
Mm-hmm.
And as I grew older, like I started to understand the writer's
perspective.
Let's say his ideology behind mm-hmm. writing such a novel itself. Mm-hmm. And it made, you know, huge waves back even when he wrote the book, and until today is trying to resurface again. So when this movie came out, I mean, in terms of, like what the sister says, in terms of visual effects, it had good visual effects. I mean, I can't deny that. But it's not the wowing aspect. It doesn't mm-hmm. have that wow aspect yes. in terms of science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And even the directors themselves, they said, if you've noticed, they said, we've never shown how these things fly. Like, there are no engines, there are nothing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they did not try to put as much work on the visual side of things, rather than they heavily invested in the story itself.
Mm-hmm.
So what seems
so
to be more
obvious...
So if it
is not the form, it's its content.
Yeah, yeah.
It's
so
its
what
message,
attracted
basically.
Me to the story, right. to the movie, not its cinematic
effects
or anything, but rather the story itself and how it unfolded.
Right. I see.
So it was captivating to me, considering the fact that it's actually a direct link to my faith.
And not to mention there are huge differences between the first movie and the second one, basically based on the original novel.
Huge, because what happened is, I think there were a lot of attempts to redo that first Dune movie,
right?
But it failed miserably.
I see.
They even made a mini-series.
Oh.
And also failed miserably.
I see.
So no one even dared to do a remake of Dune itself mm-hmm. until this one came out.
Yes.
And actually this one, the director, managed to actually, you know, do the right job by
yes.
it.
Yes, Denis Villeneuve.
Yeah. And another point I want to...
Who was the writer, by the way? Is he still alive?
No, the writer is Frank... I forgot his name.
Herbert.
Frank Herbert,
yeah.
He wrote the novel in 1968, I think.
Yes.
So it's very old story. So no, I don't think he's alive.
I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Let's take a short break by listening to another part of this movie, Dune, produced in 2021, directed by Denis Villeneuve. And then we'll be back with the rest of the critique here on the program, Viewpoint on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us.
My planet Arrakis is so beautiful when the sun is low. Rolling over the sands, you can see spice in the air. At nightfall, the spice harvesters land. The outsiders race against time to avoid the heat of the day. They ravage our lands in front of our eyes. Their cruelty to my people is all I've known. These outsiders, the Harkonnens, came long before I was born. By controlling spice production, they became obscenely rich. Richer than the Emperor himself.
Back to the program Viewpoint on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program, and Brother Sayyid Abdullah, my guest speaker, and Sister Asma, my other guest speaker in the studio. We are talking about and focusing on the movie Dune, produced in 2021, directed by Denis Villeneuve. Well, you know, Sister Asma, we see that in the early part of the movie, in fact, rather in the minute, around the minute one, rolling over the sands, you can see a spice. There is this narrator mm-hmm. talking, right? The spice in the air at nightfall, the spice, in fact, harvests land. The outsiders race against time to avoid the heat of the day. These are the, you know, basically the background information we get.
The introduction, yes.
Yes, the introduction. What does spices stand for in this movie? Well, what does it mean?
I guess before we go to that point, I would have to talk a bit about what happens in there. Because in case there's some audience who don't know what we're talking about or they haven't even read the book, well, the gist of it is that it's the movie about different sort of creatures. They're living in different planets way ahead of us, years ahead of us.
Yes.
There are three important groups in these movies who are living in different planets.
Yes.
One is Caladan, the other one is Bene Gesserit, and also another one is Gedi Prime, if I'm not mistaken. And then they are ruled by an emperor. That emperor has made a plan for the... And also we have Atreides, who lived in the Caladan. The emperor has asked them to, as a mission, to go to Arrakis.
Yes, in a order desert land.
Yes, in order to rule there. But what happens is that why they are going there is the story of the spice that you already mentioned. In that place, in that Arrakis, we have a material, a substance that everyone is longing to go there and mine those spice sort of things, in order to invest money or gather more of money. And as we can see, I'm just saying the literal things from the movie, but every single thing that we're mentioning has got a deeper meaning. So that spice that you mentioned, if I say literally, it's a substance that's going to give you a sort of immortality.
Yes.
Or that it is good for your for the health. Something like that is, has been mentioned in the very
beginning
of the movie.
And also for the Imperium, it's good for the traveling.
Yes, for traveling.
It's a fuel kind of thing.
Yes, kind of. And the doctor mentions that it's a psychoactive sort of substance that would give you a sort of... ecstasy, perhaps, in which it would lead to visions and dreams.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sister Asma. Sayyid Abdullah, you know, again, given this introduction that I gave, of course, it was mentioned at the beginning of this movie, you know, we see the desert lamb, we see the spice, we see something which is related to that kind of area and harsh weather, the violence of the sun heat, you know, the heat of the day. There's always a kind of mention or reference to a kind of, to me, global warming. Don't you agree with me? Like, they like to say that in the, for example, like on different planets or maybe in future, what man or other creatures are going to experience is a kind of like harsh weather or, global warming, generally.
Looking at
environmental consequences.
So this movie, you really need to dissect it, like very thoroughly, right? Because everything means something in real life.
Yes.
What you see in the movie itself is just words and, you know, things to reference to something else. For example, when you talk about spice, when you talk about the heat, when you talk about everything, the wars, everything has a reference to something else.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the references is the fact that you're going to have a lot of sunstorms, there's droughts, people will fight over water. And this is even in our narrations, Islamic narrations, is stated at the end of times, the war will be over water rather than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
So differently, there are references to everything that would happen in the future, because you got to take in mind the author himself, he was cross-referencing a lot of religions together to come up with this movie. So this is not just science fiction. This is actually based on texts. He even
facts.
In the movie, he used quotes from verses from the Quran.
Nice.
As if we will see later on. Yes. So it's a foresight of the future based on religions and texts. Yes. So one of the issues that we will face, which is written pretty much in all religions, is the fact that we're going to have severe catastrophes in terms of nature.
Yes.
One of which is thunderstorms, which we start to experience now, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And drought is starting to happen.
Yes, so, exactly.
There's definitely a reference to that.
I see. Okay, thank you very much for your nice contribution, Brother Sayyid Abdullah and Sister Asma. Thank you very much, my dear audience, for listening to the program Viewpoint on IRIB English Radio. In this episode and the upcoming episode, we are going to focus on the critique of the movie June, produced in 2021, directed by Denis Villeneuve. So thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Eight-year defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
As the cold season approaches, once again, Europe has been plunged heavily into an escalating energy crisis. In a recent move, Russia's Gazprom again halted its key gas pipeline indefinitely, a move decried by European politicians. Reducing reliance on Russian gas will not be simple for European countries, as this will require a concerted and sustained policy effort across multiple sectors, alongside strong international dialogue on energy markets and security. There are multiple links between Europe's policy choices and broader global market balances. Strengthened international cooperation with alternative pipeline and LNG exporters will be of high importance. Commenting on the current issues of energy security in Europe, Iran's chief diplomat Amir Abdullahian has recently stated that Iran is strongly interested in helping the international community by having its natural share in the energy market. In this regard, some lead European diplomats believe Iran's stronger entry into the energy market is in line with the interests of the world. The world oil market undoubtedly needs a rise in Iran's oil supply, according to Javad Oji, Iran's Minister of Petroleum. We are prepared to swiftly increase our supply to the market, he said, adding that the energy and gas crisis in Europe is a serious problem which cannot be solved without interaction and cooperation among major hydrocarbon producers. And the Islamic Republic of Iran, one of the world's largest oil and gas producers, is prepared to take action in this regard, relying on its huge hydrocarbon resources and production capacity. If the world's consumers, especially major economies, are dissatisfied with the current oil prices and supply levels and see it against their interests, I suggest that they lift the U.S. unilateral and cruel sanctions against Iran as soon as possible and prepare the ground for Iran to return to the global oil market with maximum capacity, he noted.
Europe is trying to supply a portion of its natural gas requirements from Africa, Algeria, Egypt, and LNG from the US, but is facing two problems. The first is securing fuel for the winter, and the second is the high prices of natural gas. Its price has risen above $2 per cubic meter, whereas our highest price for a cubic meter of natural gas for our export is around 30 cents and 20 cents for petrochemical plants. But the Europeans have to pay more than $2 for a cubic meter of natural gas. This is devastating for industry, as some steel manufacturers have stated that it's impossible to continue working with the current prices. So it looks like the real loser in the war between Russia and Ukraine has been Europe.
We should pay attention to the fact that the Europeans are acting against Russia under the pressure of the United States. The Americans are trying to present themselves as an alternative to Russia in the European natural gas market. In fact, the U.S. became the largest global LNG exporter in the past month. This shows us that the Americans have plans for the global natural gas market, and this is one of them. They want to reduce Europe's dependency on Russian natural gas so that they can further pursue their political objectives in Europe.
The return of Iranian crude remains dependent on other political events, namely what's commonly known as the Iran nuclear deal. If a deal is reached to restore the 2015 nuclear accord, the Persian Gulf nation's production could rise quickly and exports will surge even sooner. Iran's energy resources are so large that in the long run it will definitely determine the stability of the price and the stability of the world's energy supply, according to geopolitical energy experts. Iran has the equivalent of over 1.2 trillion barrels of oil and gas, according to the CEO of the National Iranian Oil Company, NIOC, Mohsen Khojastemir. He has stated that Iran is now the largest holder of hydrocarbon reserves in the world, considering its new discoveries.
Despite the sanctions, we try to increase our production capabilities, and we claim that our production capacity is at 3,880,000 barrels. We may not be able to produce as much right now because the market is unfavorable for us because of the sanctions. On the other hand, we can produce natural gas condensates up to 800,000 to 900,000 barrels per day.
With regard to in-place oil and gas and also in-place liquids and condensates, we have the equivalent of more than 1,200 billion barrels of crude under the ground. Giving a breakdown of the figure, the deputy oil minister said that Iran's extractable crude reserves are estimated at 157 billion barrels, considering the enhanced recovery rate. He added that natural gas reserves are estimated at 33 trillion cubic meters. That's 116.5 trillion cubic feet.
Based on studies conducted by reliable companies like EIA, Shell and BP, it's believed that we have between $550 to $650 billion worth of in-place crude oil reserves. They have speculated that we can extract 155 billion barrels. We are consuming roughly 1 billion barrels per year. So if we decide to halt our exports, Iran has 150 years worth of oil reserves. Few countries in the world can compare to this.
The figures come days after Iranian government officials said crude oil production in this country had reached levels seen before the United States imposed sanctions on Iran in 2018. Following its decision to withdraw from an international deal on Tehran's nuclear program. Media reports and government statements suggest crude exports from Iran have been at around 1.5 million barrels per day since late last year. That comes despite U.S. sanctions, which have sought to pile economic pressure on this country by choking off its oil export revenues, although lengthy negotiations over the restoration of the JCPOA, Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, seem to be approaching their end. But Iranian diplomats insist that nothing is agreed until everything is agreed.
The current energy crisis itself is applying pressure on the EU countries to play a sensible role in the negotiations and do something to end sanctions on Iran, and want the negotiations to yield results even more than before. Because if Iran and the US return to the JCPOA, Iran will re-enter the global oil market. It's believed that if Iran makes a comeback, the global production capacity will be increased by 1.5 to 2 million barrels per day. On the other hand, global oil prices will surely decrease to some extent.
Well, even if Iranian crude isn't going to flow to the U.S. anytime soon, that still leaves Asian buyers, such as South Korea and Japan and those in Europe. Iran's crude will return to the market more quickly than most expect, according to Iranian officials.
I think that the 13th administration has taken a positive step in energy diplomacy by following the principle of increasing relations with neighboring countries. I think there's a stable correlation between increasing ties with neighbors and developing a robust framework of energy diplomacy. I think that as we increase our relations and trade capacity with neighboring countries, by developing far-reaching ties with our neighbors, we can witness a positive impact on our energy diplomacy, like the areas you mentioned, such as energy transit, circumventing sanctions, and other issues.
If it does, it will provide welcome relief for refiners in the Mediterranean, who took around 600,000 barrels a day of Iranian crude last time round. They risk losing a similar volume of Russian barrels when further EU sanctions come into force in the coming months. And while they are not an exact match for each other, most Iranian crude would be a reasonable substitute for Urals export grade. Time for a short break. We'll be back.